You are listening to Studying Pixels, a podcast on game studies and video game culture. I'm Stefan, I'm a game studies scholar from Germany. And you can find us every Sunday on studyingpixels.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Analyzing video games is a key part of being a video game scholar. It is kind of the bread and butter of the work that we do. And it is not as simple as it may seem, because you have to do a bit more than just playing a video game and write down your thoughts on it. Especially if you want to do this systematically and you want to publish the thoughts that you develop in conversation with the game that you are playing. Now, today we're going to go deeply into the methodological aspects of analyzing video games. We're going to talk about close playing, which is a particular method that is quite common in the domain of qualitative video game analysis. In order to do so, we have a guest. We're going to talk to Teresa Tannenbaum in just a second. But before we do that, I want to briefly remind you that if you like this show and you want to help us make it happen, then you can support us by joining Studying Pixels Plus. There you can get all of our episodes entirely ad-free. You'll get a lovely sticker and monthly Plus episodes. Some of these Plus episodes go into academic subjects. They are for scholars and students. And others go deep into video game culture and video game discourse. They're very enjoyable, if I may say so myself. If you're curious about that, you can go to studyingpixels.com/plus to find out more.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Analyzing video games can be quite a challenge. Video games are often huge and take a lot more time to get through than it does for a film, for example. They also shift and change as you play them. You might not be able to get all of the text that is present just by playing through a sequence once. And then there are all kinds of further challenges, like how do you take notes? How do you acquire the material to include screenshots in your publications, for example? These are all aspects that we are going to discuss today in conversation with Teresa Tess Tannenbaum. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Informatics at the Donald Bren School of Information and Computer Sciences at the University of Irvine, California. And together with Professor Jim Bizzocchi, she published an essay in 2011. And that essay is still tremendously influential. It is called Well Read: Applying Close Reading Techniques to Gameplay Experiences. To talk about exactly how to do that, she joins us now. I'm happy to have you here. Hi, Tess.
Hi, Stefan.
So I want to start off with the broadest possible question that one could ask in the context of such a conversation, and that is, what is close playing? How would you define this method?
It is a method for making sense of a game's poetics and the underlying aesthetic and design elements of a game through the perspective of a a particular scholar. It's a subjective method for making sense of the experiences we have when we play games.
But making sense of the experience when I play games, isn't that what I do in the process of playing anyway? Like, how is it different from just, in quotation marks, playing a game?
In some ways, I think just playing a game, to use the air quotes, is the first step in close playing. I think ultimately anyone pursuing a close playing of a game needs to have that first authentic, genuine, unfiltered, immediate experience of play. What close playing does is it then repeats that process with more rigor and more focused attention and more theoretical and focused attention than one would engage in simply through play. It's a way of situating your own perspective and zeroing in on a phenomenon within the game that you're interested in order to unpack it and in some cases, reverse engineer the ways in which the game has worked its magic on you.
But you just mentioned this unfiltered first impression, right, of approaching a game. And I'm wondering, is this something like, is it okay if I have a particular research question and approach a game directly with that? Or of which value is it that I basically play a game for my own personal enjoyment before I analytically dissect it, basically?
So I advocate for us as scholars to always try to suspend our critical faculties the first time we encounter a game. And I recognize that the key word here is to try to do that, because in many ways it's very hard to turn off the part of your brain that is trained to think critically and analytically. But I feel that it's important when doing any kind of close reading or analysis to leave space for yourself to first have the joy and to first have an experience that is comparable or analogous to an experience that a non-critical reader or player would have in the game, because the game isn't designed to be analyzed by the developer and the designer. It's designed to be played. And I feel like I think it's hard to produce an analysis of an artifact that's designed for play if you haven't had that play yourself.
Yeah, the status of play here, I think, is really important, right? Because play is, at least if we look into the common definitions within game studies, it's a voluntary activity. It's an activity that does not produce any direct gains. And even like an analytical thought might already be some kind of gain. So if you say, like, I'm going to play this to analyze it, you're already in a different mindset compared to I'm going to play it to play it.
Yep. So when I was doing these kinds of critical readings of games, and it's something that I had to step away from because I had carpal tunnel syndrome that I'm only just now getting surgery for, and so I'm finally able to play again after years of not being able to.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Thank you. It's better. It's getting better. It is lovely being able to play again.
Yeah.
but when I was playing, I often, I think it was really important to maintain an active play hobby practice that is not agenda driven. The games that I choose to close read and the games that I analyzed were all games that I had encountered because I was drawn to them as a player first. And not as a scholar. I very seldom would go and seek out a game specifically to analyze it because somebody had told me to. It was always that through the course of playing, I would sort of have that part of my brain that said, "Oh, I'm going to come back to this at a certain point." And that, I think, again, helps preserve some, albeit imperfect, aspect of that authentic initial experience.
It's probably also important that we take such things like player preference into account then, because you mentioned that the games that you analyzed are usually the ones that you felt drawn to. And inevitably, I had to think of like how it would be for me if I had to analyze a video game that is part of a genre, for example, that I have absolutely no attachment to. And I think I would sincerely struggle. Of course, I could probably do something, but I would really struggle to put myself into the shoes of someone who actually enjoys this.
Yes. And I think part of what I love about hermeneutic methods in close reading is that the subjectivity of the reader is centered. We don't pretend that we're reading objectively. We don't pretend that we're reading without our own perspectives and agendas and biases. And so, I mean, the strength of a hermeneutic argument rests on any sort of claims to expertise in the analysis of the reader, and that is at least partially situated in their own perspective. If I'm going to write about a story-based game, it's going to be because I've already sort of found some joy in that game, found play in that game. I'm not like if somebody wanted me to write an analysis of a genre, like a sports game, where I don't play sports games typically. I'm not the person to write that analysis. I'm not the right close reader for that genre. But I am the right close reader for a very particular niche of story-driven games. And so I stay in my lane, as it were.
I actually had such an experience when I started out in video game journalism. I was so happy that I was picked up by a website that would give me a small amount of money for my writing. However, they were an esports website.
Oh.
And I then realized, wait, I actually have not only no clue about esports, but also not a particular interest about it. And it was right. Like, it made it into really hard work. But what I actually wanted to ask is, you just mentioned hermeneutics and the hermeneutic mm-hmm. argument. What is the hermeneutic argument?
So close reading itself is a form of hermeneutic method. It was pioneered originally by John Crow Ransom and the New Critics, which was a literary movement that arose in response to a literary movement that was focused on trying to unpack what an author was thinking. And the New Critics worked really hard to discard any assumptions about the author's state of mind and instead tried to redirect critical analysis to texts and to the things that the text was doing. But that type of method is a form of hermeneutic analysis. And hermeneutic analysis has its roots in religious theory and philosophy. I'm Jewish, and so the example I typically go to is the Talmud, which is the writings of rabbis who are interpreting the Torah. And that process of reading the text and interpreting it and making meaning and situating that meaning in their own lived experiences was the basis for early hermeneutic methods and analysis. That's known as theological hermeneutics. It was then developed into the interpretation of law, and we get juridical hermeneutics. We think about the U.S. Supreme Court issues opinions on law. And that's because it recognizes that it is interpreting a text based on its current situation in history, its current moment in society. From theological and juridical hermeneutics, we had Hans-Jörg Gadamer, who was a philosopher who pioneered philosophical hermeneutics, which was an approach to interpreting any text or textual phenomenon through this lens of subjective reading and rereading. And Gadamer talked about something known as the fusing of horizons, where you have the horizon of the text, the thing that the text is doing, and you have the perspective of the reader. And the goal is to read that text iteratively until you feel like your understanding and the understandings and meanings contained within the text have aligned, and you can start to speak with some authority about what that text is doing. And so close reading as a process is just like a sort of easier to access form of hermeneutic analysis, where you throw away a bunch of the jargon and we're left with something that's actually, when you take away a big word like hermeneutics, has a lot of really useful, practical, pragmatic ways of approaching any text and trying to extract meaning from it.
So basically, if I apply this to close playing, then it would mean we leave the authorial intent entirely aside. We don't so much think about what are the developers trying to tell us, but instead I take a video game or a video game sequence and I play it over and over again, and I sharpen my understanding of it each time I do so.
Yes, although I will say that the New Critic's desire to discard the author, they went too far. Like they had a, I'm trying to remember the name of this paper. I'm not going to summon it off the top of my head. But they wrote an article where they argued that you needed to throw away authorial intent and focus solely on the text. And then there was a sequel to that, which was to throw away your own emotional response and focus solely on the text. And it gets to a point where there actually is no meaning to be made, and the act of reading gets eliminated, and it actually stops being possible to do the thing that they advocated for, and ultimately their approach wasn't successful. I tend to take a fairly context inclusive approach to close reading, because I see all of that as salient, that like the moment in which I read a game matters, because who I am in that moment affects what I'm going to see and the kinds of observations I'm going to make. The knowledge that I bring to the game from either previous play sessions or from things that I have read in theory or from my knowledge of the developers changes the way in which I'm going to interpret a game. And there was this thing that happened in as Gadamer's hermeneutics was being developed, where Edmund Husserl, a well-known German philosopher, I think German, quote me on this, but had this notion of phenomenological reduction. And he had this idea that you could essentially try to eliminate as much of your own subjectivity as possible during a reading and be left with something that was more pure and more objective. And this was at a moment when objective sciences were you know, sort of increasing in their influence epistemologically. And that notion of phenomenological reduction has since been discarded by people who do hermeneutics, because it's not possible. Like we don't have the ability to get outside of our own subjectivity. We don't have the ability to set aside who we are. And in a lot of ways, who we are matters. Like the fact that I'm a transgender woman changes the way I read a text. It affects what I see, it affects what I focus on. And that isn't a source of confounding information. That's a source of value. That is a perspective that, if I can articulate that perspective, you learn more about the text and about my reading of it, knowing how I have approached it and who I am coming into it. And you also learn more about me as the reader. And so they both become more illuminated.
But how do you find a good balance when it comes to the significance of subjectivity? Because I do totally understand that it's inevitable to exclude subjectivity entirely, because it would mean that it would be some kind of computing machine that would just process
ChatGPT, do a close reading of Assassin's Creed.
Exactly. And even that would probably not be objective, because it's learned on texts that have already been written by people who were subjective. But on the other hand, of course, when you do something that qualifies as an academic analysis, it needs to go beyond what you would find, for example, in a video game review or in a blog post where someone talks about what they like or dislike about the game. How do you find a balance between those two opposite poles?
So there are some strategies that I use when I do readings. One is to develop, and actually spend a lot of time developing and focusing in on analytical lenses as a reading tool. And this is one of the things that sets these types of methods apart from more grounded theory approaches, in that we actually, I will go to theory and I will build out a series of questions that are rooted in existing theoretical concerns within the field. And I will use that to focus my playing, because typically when you're reading a game, it's too big to do an all-purpose reading. Like games, unlike novels or film, are the combination of indeterminacy and unexpected system behaviors and the influence of your own skill as a player on the experience and the sheer number of hours involved in it. It's you simply cannot do a holistic, inclusive reading of most games. And so you need to find a way of sharpening your focus. And I find that theoretical lenses do the work of both orienting you towards a particular phenomenon within the text and also helping you to strike that balance between your own subjectivity as a player and your goals as a scholar to produce a contribution to knowledge.
So an example might maybe be, if I understand this correctly, that let's say I play Final Fantasy VII, for example. Let's say I play Final Fantasy VII Remake or something, and I have this initial first impression, and then I form an analytical lens maybe by engaging with the subject of environmentalism, and then I shape analytical lenses by forming specific questions. I want to basically inquire into the game through the lens of this particular question as to how is the dystopia of a planet being exploited portrayed in Final Fantasy VII. Would that be an analytical lens?
Yeah, so what I will typically do from a pure pragmatic standpoint is I will make a list of questions. I typically have one or two analytical lenses I'm interested in when I'm reading a text. Because I have ADHD and my brain is interested in all the things. But I will typically print out, like, hard copy of my question sheets and tape them up next to my monitor while I'm playing. And I will have note-taking apparatus open, like I'll have a tablet or a laptop open. And so while I play, I have in the corner of my mind, in the periphery of my experience, these questions that are just keeping me from completely losing sight of what I'm doing as a scholar. And if something happens that I worry is going to be forgotten, if I do something or experience something where my brain goes, ooh, this question is addressed here. I need to note that. I will note it down. I also have passive recording going. So I typically set up Fraps, which is a screen capture application, to do a screenshot every second while I play, so that I can go back through the image archive and pull out data and also use that to cue my own recall. And so I'll do that in the real-time aspect of play. And then when I'm done with a game or with a play session, I will sit down with my sheet of analytical lenses and questions, and I will go through and do a debrief where I'll answer each question to the best of my ability based on what I experienced, and then I'll go and play again. And typically what happens is that some questions end up not being interesting. Some of the questions that I found, some of the things that were happening in the theory either aren't present in the game and therefore aren't being satisfied and aren't really going to yield any knowledge. And other questions explode in this spiderweb of additional new questions that I hadn't anticipated. And so I create a new sheet of questions, and I put those up, and I do the next playing with the new sheet, and I document the evolution of the analytical lens, because what you end up with is a conversation that is happening between you and the game, and the analytical lens's evolution becomes a trace of how your relationship to the theory develops, and it becomes a way of demonstrating rigor and of making your process of reading accessible to the person who's going to read your theory. So they can be like, okay, well, was she just picking and choosing these ideas? No, actually, she was looking at all these ideas, and then the text was what showed her where to go next. And it's a way of demonstrating rigor and validity to an academic community that can often be skeptical of subjective methods.
Yeah, so that you show that you're not just taking just that one particular aspect that conveniently fits that one particular sequence, but instead that you approached it from a more broader perspective and narrowed it down to these points.
Yep, because it is it is common when receiving reviews of this work to have people question whether or not you created a self-fulfilling prophecy, whether you yeah. said, I'm interested in this and this game has this. And so I read this and I found this. And I think it's very easy to challenge close readings on those grounds if the person doing the reading hasn't been rigorous about documenting their process and articulating how they have approached the text, why they've approached the text, and how they have reached the conclusions they have reached.
What I do as well is that I always record my first playthrough so that I can go back, look at the material again, also conveniently to basically make screenshots from the videos. So I do it in a very similar process that you do. And what I find most convenient about it is that it kind of relieves me from the necessity of taking notes all the time. Because while playing, of course, I will have lots of thoughts running through my mind, but I withhold from noting all of them down because maybe once in a while, if it's something really important that I hadn't thought of before, but usually I will not constantly pause to take a note because it will interrupt my engagement yep. with the video game.
And that's one of those things that, depending on the game you're playing and how much data you're generating, sometimes I think, like, so I know groups that do video recording, like Bernard Perron's group at UCAM in Montreal, they have actually written some papers about their process of recording videos of their playthroughs and going back and analyzing them. I found that for my own process, I turn on subtitles, first of all, for everything, so that when I'm getting screenshots, I'm getting any dialogue that's being spoken that way. And I do a fairly dense screenshot process. And actually, at the end of any play session, part of what I do is I organize and sort out my screenshots, which helps me cue my own recall. And I find that from a data storage standpoint, I don't have to have as large of a hard drive when doing yeah. that. And that it also, it's much easier for me to find a moment when I can scroll through a directory of large thumbnails than it is to try to scrub through a video. That video can be, like, it's higher fidelity, but it's much harder to work with when you're trying to access things. And it's nice to have all the screenshots ready so I can just pull out the screenshots and drop them right into the paper. Because the thing that Jim Bozoki, my graduate advisor, hammered into me from the moment I started graduate school was to always ground it in the text. That the close reading is, at its core, an empirical method. As weird as that sounds, and I'm not an empiricist in terms of my epistemology, but it is ultimately, if you are going to make an argument, you need to be able to support that argument with evidence. And your evidence base is the game. It is the text. You need to be able to point to it and say, I experienced this and I interpret it this way, but here is the thing that I experienced, so that other people can you know, assess whether or not they're going to buy the argument you're making.
Yeah, it's a different kind of empirical data. Empirical data is not just huge quantitative numbers, but it can also be a qualitative observation of something like a video game text, right?
Yep.
Well, I find the method very appealing with the screenshots, though I was just thinking, I should really implement this. I find it actually convenient also because, yeah, my hard drive is easily, like, you know, clogging yep. up. But the thing is, yeah. most video game consoles don't allow me to do that, I think. Like, with Fraps, it's possible, but with a video game console, I would always have to click the button to make a screenshot, right?
That is true. And this is something where, this is something that my students and I have encountered because I developed all of these techniques playing on a PC. And so I have never been a console gamer. And so I had students who wanted to close read console games in my classes. I've had students who've wanted to play mobile games in my classes. And I'll be like, here, use Fraps to do screenshots. And they're like, Tess, I can't do that. I'm on an Xbox. And what I found is that you need to invest in some hardware to do this. That we have a pretty high quality video capture card that we run to a PC so that when I'm playing anything on a console, it's outputting its data to a computer that is running Fraps, that is then doing a screenshot capture. There are adapter cables that will let you plug mobile phones into these, that will let you do screen capture from the phone. And that has been the solution that I have found because, and again, we're talking like nuts and bolts here.
Yeah.
That is a way to expand this method to include consoles and mobile devices, which is where most people are playing their games right now.
Yeah, at least with the PS5, there's like an integrated recording feature. So what I would do is I would record my only the first playthrough usually. And then I would, once I'm done, the internal hard drive of the PS5 would be about to explode. I would quickly take everything, shovel everything over onto an external hard drive, basically.
And that's, I think, absolutely the way to go. I'm embarrassed to admit that I've been out of the playing game space for so long. I don't even have a PS5 in my lab. I haven't caught up with it. We just got a Switch, so that's where I'm at.
Ah, the Switch is beautiful, though. It doesn't have a recording feature, but it's a beautiful console.
It's an elegant console.
Well, I was also wondering, one issue of subjectivity is, of course, that we want to maintain that balance. We want to bring in an analytical lens to prevent our readings from being too subjective. But one point that at least I have not encountered, but that I find very important to stress, is that when we analyze video games and when we engage in a close reading, I take comfort in the fact that we're not alone. Like that we actually, I mean, the reason why we publish these things is so that other people can read it and then get into conversation with that analysis and maybe agree or disagree. So I find some comfort in the fact that, yes, I am, of course, to some degree, trapped within the confines of my own subjectivity. But on the other hand, there are many other subjectivities out there that might present an alternative reading to the one that I have presented.
Absolutely. I think the other point that I would love to emphasize here is that because this is a method that ultimately rests upon the perspective of the person doing the reading, one of the best ways to improve yourself as a scholar is to sharpen your perspective, is to read more, is to play more, is to develop your expertise, because most claims to authority with a hermeneutic methods are rhetorical, right? They rest upon your capacity to make your case, to make an argument for why your interpretation of the game is useful to people, is going to be of value to the next person who comes along. And you're never going, like, you don't make claims about capital T truth when you're doing a close reading. Like, I'm never going to say, like, this is what the game means. I'm going to say, this is what the game meant to me in this moment. And hopefully, I have spent enough time reading and playing and thinking that I bring an expertise to it. So when I say, this is what the game meant to me, somebody can read that and be like, oh yeah, she's got good points. She's saying things that are helping me in my understanding of the game, that are changing how I would play the game. And that's ultimately, I think, the kinds of contributions to knowledge that we can make with this technique, is this dialectical contribution where we're each a piece of a conversation around the game. And ideally, we want that to be a good conversation with people.
Yeah, we can also maybe practice things like deliberately developing alternative interpretations of texts. Because I 100% agree that I would also never claim this is the meaning of this text, and now we're basically case closed, it's done. That would be kind of an antithesis to hermeneutics. But I would try, and if I develop an analysis, I would look at it again afterwards, and I would think, can this also be read in a completely different way, potentially? Mm-hmm. And then I would include that alternative reading into my argument as well.
Well, and what that's actually a perfect opportunity to talk about one of the other techniques that Jim and I developed that I really found useful when I was approaching texts as a student, which was to produce this kind of imagined phenomenology for playing a text. This, like Jim talked about it in terms of the imagined naive reader, which is how he approached work in his master's thesis. When I did my work on Oblivion, I played through opening sequences as if I were the kind of player who doesn't care about story. And then I played again as if I were the kind of player that was only focused on this particular aspect of play. And those as if playings, those subjunctive playings, are a powerful tool for both defamiliarizing your experience of a text, making a text fresh and new and getting a new perspective on it, and also for expanding the scope of the kinds of claims you can make. Because the thing that really sets close playing aside, apart from watching a film or reading a novel or another static media, is that you are making choices that are changing how the text is presenting itself to you. And that's a thing that gives you a lot of power over what you read. Like if you and I both sit down to play the same game and you have hundreds of hours of expertise in that game and I'm playing it for the first time, you will be experiencing materially a very different media artifact than what I am experiencing, because your expertise is going to inform the kinds of things you see, the amount of time you spend in any given section of a text. Both of these perspectives bring value to it. An expert perspective allows you to see things that the text can offer that an amateur or a novice wouldn't be able to access. A novice perspective brings oftentimes happy accidents and other outcomes that an expert would never encounter because they know better. And both provide a new angle into facets of a text or a game that are equally interesting depending on the kind of work you're doing.
Yeah, and especially in that Oblivion analysis, I read that analysis and I found it super interesting that by taking on these different, let's just say subjectivities for now, or phenomenological perspectives, by playing this sequence kind of as if you were different people playing it and experimenting with it, you manage to understand some more profound things about the workings of that sequence. For example, if I recall correctly, just that in this Oblivion introduction, it would measure the things you do, and then it would suggest a class to you, and you realize that it measures some things while it doesn't measure other things. And that, of course, is an observation that would only reveal, that you can only reveal by playing several times with different approaches.
Yep. And in that particular one, what I found really interesting about it was that there was this mismatch between what the game was measuring and what the player could intend through their actions. And it specifically rested upon the fact that one of the skills that you would increment through play was athletics. And athletics happened whenever your character was running. It was essentially an ambient passive thing occurring in the background. And I think I can say safely that there are very few players that are willing to walk slowly through the opening dungeon of a game when a running option is available to them with no consequences. And so this thing that wasn't really a meaningful expression of intent from the player, it was simply a pragmatic aspect of navigating the environment, was weighted as heavily as all the other things that players were doing. And in doing so, it confounded their model's ability to make sense of what a player is doing. And it resulted in recommendations that were quite off base. It took playing in extremely artificial ways to be recommended certain classes that should have been available through that model without having to play in an artificial way.
I'm actually the kind of player that slowly walks through an intro dungeon. I actually have this problem that I often walk slowly through a video game, and then I then complain that the video game's too huge. It's like the world is too huge, and then
right,
like,
because you're walking.
Because I'm walking. Because why would I run? You know, there's no diegetic reason for why my character would run, so I just walk.
I love that. I love that so much. I love finding. So this is something I'm really interested in, because I see it actually as a kind of queering of the game design in some ways. I had a graduate student who's now has his PhD and doing wonderful work out in the world, but he invariably, in a game that had a moral choice system, would pick the neutral option every time. And I was like, are you a sociopath? What's wrong with you? like who does that? Because I'd never met anybody who didn't have a strong preference to go with either the like in Mass Effect, the Paragon versus the Renegade option, or, you know, the light side of the Force versus the dark side of the Force. Like there's actual analytics on this, where if you look at the development of the Mass Effect games, the third Mass Effect game, they removed the vast majority of the neutral dialogue choices because they were able to get telemetry that showed that players didn't pick them, that nobody wanted them. And so why would you invest development cycles into a thing that only a tiny fraction of your player population was going to be interested in experiencing?
Yeah, it's like you kind of negate the significance of the choice if you just say, either way is good for me.
I'm just okay. And like, yeah, okay, Commander Shepard is so much less interesting than Renegade Shepard or Paragon Shepard. Like, it's like the gray jello of Shepard.
Yeah. Well, here's the last question. There are many people out there who start out with game studies and who have their first experiences with video game analysis before them. Do you have any tips for such fresh new students that try to just fumble around with the method a little bit and develop their own first analyses?
So I see this in my classes, and I've seen this when I've taught this method, which is that I will ask a student to, you know, write to pick a game and do a close reading for the end of the quarter, and they will write what amounts to a game review rather than a game analysis. And it's pretty common. And part of it is recognizing that, especially at the beginning, you may not have a thing to argue, but that ultimately these kinds of analysis are rhetorical. You're making a case for something. You have a point you want to make, ideally. And so when thinking about what you want to close read, I think it's really important to look at what matters to you as a person, what matters to you as a scholar. What is the work that speaks to you? What are the questions that you have that haven't been answered? And to in some ways spend as much time developing yourself as a lens as actually doing the analytical work, because the perspective and the point of view of the reader plays such a huge role in these analyses that you can't neglect it. You can't just do it without doing that work on yourself, which means when you approach a text, like, you need to have questions. You need to have curiosity. You need to have something that you really don't know about it that you would like to have answered by it. And you want to genuinely want those answers. And they need to matter. And ideally, they need to be in conversation with things that other people think matter as well. Because otherwise, we're just writing game reviews.
That was Theresa Tannenbaum, co-author of the article Well Read, Applying Close Reading Techniques to Gameplay Experiences. Tess has actually written another article that is more recent and where she discusses some of the subjects as well that we spoke about in the interview. That article is called Hermeneutic Inquiry for Digital Games Research. We will link to both of these articles in the show notes, as well as to her website that represents some of her current work. That is transformativeplay.ics.uci.edu. We're going to put the links in the show notes, so feel free to check them out if you are curious. Of course, we're always intrigued by the problems that you might encounter while producing close readings and the pragmatic solutions that you have found for yourself. If you wish to share those insights, then feel free to do so. You can go to studyingpixels.com/contact to reach out, or you can join our Discord server. Just go to our website and hit, I think it's the follow button. I actually forgot the name of the button. There's a button there. It's a button on the website. And you can click on Discord then, and it will throw you right into our server. We'd be very happy to receive you there. Thank you so very much for listening, and we will be back next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.